All right, so as we come out of the meditation, I'm going to go into our recap talk from last week, and then we'll have a chance for a little break, and then coming back for some small group discussions. So coming out of the meditation just takes a couple moments for me to change gears. But this picture, return to the origin, back to the source, again, part of this 10 series of ox herring pictures, really depicting the whole spiritual practice, the whole journey and its potential. And this is a very, this is kind of the depth of the practice here, the deepest aspect. It's not the finishing. It's not the end of the path. That's where the next picture comes in when we integrate what we've learned. So I want to just touch upon, kind of give us a sense of this picture. And I think it's important, you know, for those of us who've had taste of this or some sense of this, how that becomes like almost a North Star in our practice, in our lives too. It allows us to see things in a different way, in a different perspective than our normal contraction of mind and heart. It usually sets up this duality, this sense of separation, to realize that there is this potential of that release. And if we haven't tasted that or haven't seen that, to have that be a way of just holding a little bit of healthy skepticism into what our minds say, into the way we're struggling with something, that maybe there is something to what the Buddha talked about, something that he was pointing toward. And there's also an important pitfall that we can sometimes fall into. If we get too focused on this picture, these deep states at the expense of really meeting our lives, of meeting our relationships, our struggles, our story. So I want to try to touch upon all of those. So this image is really pointing to a deep quality of awakening, of enlightenment. You know, what the Buddha discovered and that all the students over the years have also discovered through their own practice. And so when we really look at this picture and talk about the verse, it's harder to get a real handle on it from our normal perspective, because it's going to this, it's kind of transcending so much of our normal duality and separation. It transcends, it wipes through that. And so let's just try to see if we can understand it a little bit more. So just to read the verses, having returned to the source, effort is over. The intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. Still, the endless river flows tranquilly on. The flowers are red. And then the verse, the translation we have on the website, too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on, and the flowers are red. So I like using these two different translations because they help inform each other. So what is this picture about? What is that he talking about, or whoever authored this? I'm going to turn off my picture. For those online, you can see the image, and those, let me see if I can pin myself. For those in line, you can see, or in person, maybe you can see the little image there of the, it's a very ordinary image. There's not a strikingness to it like the other images. There's not a clear sense of the person and the ox and the struggle and all the drama. And just a really peaceful picture of this branch with these leaves. There's a sense of nothing much is happening here. Now this itself, this ordinariness, this simplicity is part of the pointing of this awakening. Remember the last picture, the picture of the Enzo, that dramatic ink circle that's drawn in one brush. It's just very striking. Some say it's the image of Zen. It's like that, and that's another quality of awakening, is that there's this brilliance to it, this intensity to it, that just takes our breath away, that there's no place where our thoughts can land. We're just, it's so immense. And yet that's just a stage. And then the next, the deeper stage is this falling into this just tranquility. Now, I'm going to read a couple interpretations of this state. First by Dogen, the patron saint of Zen. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. This is a very deep statement pointing to this profound shift of our normal perspective. And that's really the heart of it, is that sense of me who's having that experience, me who's struggling with my life, me who's trying to become awakened, me who's seeking after the ox, struggling to find and tame, master the ox, join with the ox. And even when the ox falls away, there's still the sense of the person sitting there in repose in the hut, ox forgotten, self remains. And the self vanishes, and the self and ox are both forgotten, last month's picture. And yet there's still that perspective of, oh, this is really vast. This is really big. This is a big shift. There's still a sense of observing it, not a complete falling into it. And Dogen speaks of it this way, that there's no trace of enlightenment remains. Well, last month, there was that trace of enlightenment, this beautiful image, this powerful image of the Enzo. And this no trace continues endlessly. So this description isn't just a Buddhist, for my belief. I may be a little a heretic in saying this, but I don't see it as a purely a Buddhist experience. And enlightenment is not something that just Buddhist experience. I think any religion, especially ones which are contemplative or have a mystical quality, have this potential. I think that's the heart of so many of them, is trying to realize this. You can see in some of the Sufi poems really bring that forward. One of my favorite Christian mystic from the 600s, I should say, Meister Eckhart. This is what he said about God. So he's using God as a way of describing this experience. You know, so whatever your sense of God is, maybe suspend that for a moment and listen to how he describes it. So he was also a heretic. He had a lot of criticism for how he portrayed his practice, what he pointed toward. One of the areas he got a lot of criticism around was being a feminist, really bringing forth the feminine in his practice. And you can hear that in this little piece. So someone asked, or he's responding to this query, how should one love God? One should love God mindlessly, meaning that your soul ought to be without mind or mental activities or images or representations. Bear your soul of all mind. Stay there without mind. Let your own being you sink away and melt into God's being God. In this way, your you and God's her will become a completely one mind. And you will come to know her changeless existence and her nameless nothingness. So this is a very mystical, mysterious, and also very concrete way of describing the awakened state. Is really the aim of Dharma practices to awaken, is to open to enlightenment. And remember, one of the pitfalls is that we think we have to be, we are the ones who become enlightened. We're the ones who are transformed. And that in itself sets up this duality. Suzuki Roshi, I believe, said that strictly speaking, there's no such thing as an enlightened person, only enlightened actions. Only enlightened actions. So classically, the different pathways or maps of awakening have this practice, practice, practice. There's an insight, a realization. We take that, we practice some more. There's a deeper realization, maybe leading to a complete realization, and then finally integration back into life. And this is how these Oxherding pictures go. But for many of us, that integration needs to happen as we go along. We have insights, we see life differently, and then we apply it. We see, how does this actually show up in the very struggles of my life? I think this integration is so critical in our practice to avoid that sense of spiritual bypassing, that sense of avoiding what's difficult, that we bring our lives really into the midst of our practice and our practice into the midst of our lives. Ram Dass said that if you think you are enlightened, go and spend a week with your family. Right? So you go and spend your week with your family, and you realize, okay, it wasn't quite as deep or as sustained as I thought it could. And this is the question from the homework from last week, is reflecting on the difference between formless, the emptiness, this deep stillness, this deep realization. And what does it have to do with our story, with our struggle, with our life's difficulties, our life's joys? How do those relate to each other? And different traditions, even let's just speak about Buddhism, sometimes bias themselves toward one or the other. So Zen, from which these pictures come from, tend to bias toward, kind of crudely speaking, enlightenment or bust. You know, it's like everything is enlightenment. So you just work and strive and practice until there's a Satori moment, a deep understanding, right? And then even in Zen, they say you have the Satori, you have the awakening, and then you spend time integrating that. And in our Western Vipassana world, the way that we've interpreted it and added our kind of understanding of the mind and psychology and all those pieces, we perhaps spend a little too much time on the integration and working with how do we skillfully work things. And we sometimes forget about the whole point of the practice is awakening. So how do we bring those together? How do we find some balance in our lives? Often when I'm talking with students, I try to listen to where they are in this spectrum. Are they people who are really oriented toward awakening and realization, and that's the most important thing for them? Or are there people who are really kind of lost and trying to find some way of, not so much lost, but trying to navigate the difficulties of their lives, and they're in some ways struggling a lot with that? And for both groups, as someone who's really oriented toward awakening, I'm often curious as how do they deal with conflicts? How do they deal with how functional are they in their lives? How are they when they go home to spend a week with their family? You know, how is that? So in some ways, they often need to focus or bring more awareness into how their lives are. While the other group, who maybe we were really caught in, or not so much caught, I keep saying caught, you can hear my own biases in this, but let's say their struggles in their lives are really right to the forefront. They need to also learn to see the transcendence of that, to see the release of this story. And so both, they see there's a back and forth that needs to ultimately happen. So ultimately, there's no friction in our minds or our hearts with the presence or absence of the story. With the presence or absence of grief, of difficulty, of contraction of heart, there's this willingness to naturally turn toward both. Once it's present or it's not present, There's not a bias. There's not a sense of wanting one or the other. That's when our life starts to become, our spiritual life becomes much more mature. This is where we go in next month. So how do we know, when do we release the story? When do we turn toward the story? I was asked this question of Judith Rodger, who was teaching here for Sims as a guest teacher Friday night a few weeks past. Just like, how do you know when you need to switch gears, when you need to add something else to your spiritual practice, to not just rely just on meditation, but realize maybe psychotherapy or maybe working in recovery or these different aspects are also needed. And her response, which I thought was a good one, was noticing where the suffering is, noticing where the pain is, and how are we relating to that pain? Is there a way, ability to open to it, to meet it, to see it and eventually see the emptiness that's underneath it? Or is there a pulling away or avoiding that pain? I think that's one of the key pieces here. And that's where the sincerity of our practice comes in. You know, are we able to notice when we are kind of avoiding things? Because we can take this kind of a picture and those kind of experiences, and we can incline our minds toward them. We incline our practice toward them as a way of escaping pain. It's like, okay, I just need to go check out. I need to go on a retreat. I need to get away from this craziness. And sometimes that's a wise choice. You really do need to get away. You need a respite. And sometimes it's a little bit of an avoidance. That's where is that line? So only we can know for ourselves what's true for us. Are we avoiding? Are we moving from avoidance or from wisdom, discernment or reaction? And the same too, when we just find that we have no space with our struggles, it's like, okay, what am I believing is true here? How can I see through that in a way that allows that to fall away its grip of identification? As they also say in Zen, the way to nibbana is through samsara. The way to an awakening is through this churning thing of life. I think some of the modern teachers like Byron Katie, in what she calls The Work, really asks us to challenge what we believe is true. And is this really true? Or is it just an assumed relative truth? So this is a beautiful way of turning toward the very struggle in our lives as a way of growing from that spiritual growth. So I want to just go through very quickly the lines here in the last couple minutes. So having returned to the source, effort is over. Having returned to the source, the effort is over. I think that's one of the really striking things when you have glimpses into these states, is that you realize something has really fallen away, and that's this effort of trying to be other than, to try to change how you are. And if we're honest, that's kind of constantly in the background. It's always this trying to, I remember being in the stage in my practice where I had this, I called it the Dharma coach, who said, okay, do a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that, a little more samadhi, a little bit more loving kindness, and just constantly trying to tweak things to make it just right. And of course, we know the very obvious ways of that shows up, just the intense struggle. But when these states happen, there's this that falls away. There really is nothing wrong with the moment. I often try to point to that in our meditation instructions, trying to practice relating to the moment as if there's nothing that needs to be changed. That's helping us start to incline us to the potential that they're actually, in this very moment, the impulse to change anything has fallen away. So we're practicing it until we realize it. And then the intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. this one, it's a wonderful pointing toward the release of separation. Because usually just right now, as you're listening, as you're seeing, perhaps, if you step back a little bit and just notice the assumption, there's a sense of you who's hearing. There's stuff that's external to you. I'm hearing the traffic. I'm hearing the fan and the tree, the plane overhead. Right? But I'm the one who's hearing it. It's outside of me. Right? So what if there was nothing outside? Meaning that there's no sense of separation. This is what Bahia in that famous sutta from the Buddha was telling the Bahia to see in the reference to the herd, only the herd. In reference, this is how you should train yourself. For when you, there would be only the herd in reference to the herd. Then there is no you in connection with that. When there's no you in connection with that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This is the end of dukkha. And see how Meister Eckhart echoed that in his way of describing the state. Let your own being you melt away and melt into God's being God. In this way, your you and God's her will become a completely one mind. And you'll come to know her changeless existence and her nameless nothingness. And then finally, still the endless river flows tranquilly on. Still life has its flow. And this is this paradox that we so often, from this normal state of mind that we're constantly looking at stuff, other people, ourselves, experience, and we're fixing it in relationship to us. I have to do something. I have to have an opinion around it. I have an opinion around it. Of course I'm right. Of course I'm wrong. All those things. It's a solidifying of life. And we open to this. Nothing is outside. There's no separation. When the effort has fallen away, lo and behold, the river keeps going by. Life keeps flowing. When we realize suddenly that it's always been flowing, we've just been trying to relate to it as being frozen. And then we find ourselves in harmony with life. We realize we ourselves is whatever we take ourselves to be is also constantly flowing, constantly arising and passing away. And the flowers are red. You know, back to the auspiciousness of this seeing, of this new beginning. So this is a very deep dharma. It may be, again, beyond what our experience is. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have value. It helps inspire us. It helps us question what we take as being solid. And if we have had taste of this, remember those tastes as we're face to face with something that's so solid, so gripping. It helps us to orient our practice in a way that is very, very beneficial. All right, so I think that's enough words for that, and then we'll come back in 5 minutes for some discussion, really digging into this question of how does form and story work together? How do they relate? So we'll come back at 8:10 for some small groups. Thank you. So the homework from last week was to reflect on emptiness and form. So this picture points toward this really profound aspect of emptiness. And so you might talk about what your understanding of that or your experience might be, but particularly noticing how emptiness relates to form, particularly our story. So when I say story, I'm talking about that whole gestalt of, you know, this happened to me this when I was a kid, and this changed how I see the world and how my relationships all got kind of convoluted because of that. All those kind of that emotional, mental, behavioral, that's a big piece, the way we show up in the world, what we believe about ourselves and others, right? So how does emptiness relate to that? And can the story be sustained in emptiness? So whatever, you know, you may not have had a deep experience that this picture is pointing to, But you've all had moments that you've just felt kind of still. There's a sense of quiet, a sense of being at ease in the moment. And nothing, you know, you don't have to do a lot in the moment. And how in that moment, you know, the story doesn't have as much momentum. You know, so can the story be sustained in emptiness? And is that always a beneficial thing? Is it always good to go into the stillness out of the story? Or sometimes is the story important to really open to explore, as Judith talked about, that sense of digesting it, really working with it until it finally releases from us? And then what guides our choice? Emptiness or story? Is that a conscious choice? Right. So I know I kind of threw out a bunch of words, but hopefully you can get that this essence of that. Basically, stillness, emptiness, story, struggle. How do we hold those two? Are they contradictory? Are they actually a way to find that they can both support each other? All right. Does it make any sense? Kind of. Not seeing a lot of nods. That's a little disconcerting. How about online? Do you guys? Okay, I've got some more positive feedback online. Great. All right, well, now ring the bell to bring us back. Okay, all right, everyone's back. All right, so let's see how that conversation went. I'm curious, yeah, what you talked about, what you explored. I know it's a little esoteric, it's a little out there, maybe hard to dig into, but sometimes that's good for our practice, is to struggle a little bit with what's beyond our, you know, our normal words. So we have some space for any questions or sharing you might have. And those online, you can raise your virtual hand. And those in person, you can raise your live hand. All right, Iris, go ahead.
Thank you. I think that we kind of talked about how we wanted to sort of integrate emptiness and form, how we thought, and golly, I realize that I'm saying we, and I don't mean to be putting words in other people's mouths, but it feels like there was sort of a consensus. Jean, shake your head if I'm doing okay. and we spoke a lot, I think, about mindfulness, and that was something that was both present and important when we were in form, or when we were that they're not mutually exclusive, form and formlessness. And that to be present, to be mindful, and now I'm just sort of making it up, I don't know that we even spoke about this, is always a good thing. And it's a good thing to be mindful when you're doing your whatever, functioning in the world. And it would be hard to experience emptiness without being mindful. I think that might be correct. So, sorry, as I rambled in the group, I'm rambling now, so I will stop.
It was a lovely ramble, and it didn't seem like it was too rambly, actually. So, yeah, absolutely. The sense of mindfulness really helps us engage in those details of our lives. Is really a helpful companion to bring forth. And that way, yeah, in terms of being mutually exclusive, I mean, I think we could say that we can be so lost in our struggle, lost in our reaction, that we're not mindful. You know, so that from that place, yeah, it doesn't hold mindfulness. But mindfulness, you know, by its nature is designed to hold these different things. Absolutely. And just to kind of take it a little deeper, that Rodney used to talk about mindfulness versus awareness in this way. And, you know, I think I agree with him, you know, just as I practice more. And I think it's a helpful kind of way of thinking about it, that mindfulness is we're still choosing to be mindful, right? So I'm choosing to pay attention to this impulse to lash out. I'm choosing to be present to this breath, but there's still this kind of this volitional piece. There's this choice piece, this intentionality that I'm applying my mindfulness. I'm choosing to shift the way I'm relating to this moment and whatever it might hold from a more spacious, receptive, present way. Okay, very helpful, very essential in our practice. Now, versus awareness is when there's not that intention of choosing. It's like the awareness is just simply there. You know, analogy that, I don't know if it's helpful, but you think of it like a flashlight. I shine the flashlight on this or that, this body part, this sensation, this emotion, this experience. I'm choosing where that light focuses, the depth of the focus, all that stuff. Versus just the light in the room automatically is just seeing everything. It's bathing everything with a quality of knowing, of awareness. Now, the big contrast between those two states is one, there's a sense of me who's doing it. And it's certainly, it's a much more beneficial to have a sense of you who's trying to be mindful than not being mindful. Absolutely. And the practice points in a deeper way to that sense of you falling away, seeing through the illusion of it. It's not so much it falls away, but you just stop believing it. You see that there's actually a deeper, much more fundamental reality that's underneath self or not self. Okay. In that place, you know, there's like the light just touching everything, bathing everything without any preference. There's not even me who's showing up. And that's the state that, you know, these mystics point to and try to put words to, right? Like Meister Eckhart, the Buddha. I'm sure we can find in any religious tradition, the mystical sides, this comes forth, right? Now, in that place, the story doesn't have much purchase, because it's like there's such a vastness of stillness, a vastness of presence, that the story just is kind of vanishes. Remember, like last month, there's a phrase, it might have been a translation I didn't use, but there's a translation where the, how can a snowflake exist in the fire? Like the snowflake being a thought, there's no space for a thought to even arise. So in that way, the story really has no bearing. There's no purchase in that. And so there's a deepening of the practice with that. And there's also a potential for avoiding our life, avoiding the struggle of our life. Because we can say, okay, I'm just going to go into that place. I'm going to allow myself surrender into that sense of stillness. And then my story vanishes. Right? So the test is when you have to use Ram Dass's question, if you go home and spend a week with your family, is that still there? You know, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, is that still there when you're talking to someone on the opposite side? If it's not, then it's a state instead of a deep realization. Go ahead, Iris, you have a follow-up?
Well, you know, we assume that the Buddha was fully enlightened. And so one can be fully enlightened and be very functional. And to be fully enlightened is to see through the delusion of self. So he did, and yet he was functional. So it seems as if something you just said was a bit in opposition to what I just said, but maybe not.
No, what I just said was kind of pointing to the way the story can be kind of just vaporized, if you will. And when the story is vaporized, you're not going to be very employable. You're not going to be a very good partner in a relationship, because you're just like, it's all empty. So it's kind of like, if we're going to say, let's say we go from being very functional to kind of eroding that functionality, And then we kind of in this, I can't really do anything. And then we come back into being functional, but it's informed by that understanding of emptiness. That's where the next picture points to. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Buddha, and that's really the full maturing of this practice, is that we don't just stay in this picture or even the last picture. It's like we ultimately go back into our lives. And that's really the koan, is how do we meet really the difficulty of life, the sorrow of life, the dukkha of life, full heartedly, and at the same time having this deep perspective of emptiness. Like Nisargadatta said that when I look inside, I see that I am nothing. When I look outside, I see that I'm everything. You know, in between, that's love. I'm messing up the translation or the, and in between the two of those, that's where my life flows. Right. So that's the piece there, is that we can, it's almost for most of people, we perhaps need to go through this stage of really opening to that emptiness in such a profound way. And then there's this rebuilding it back in. How do we actually be a human being? How do we be fully human and fully transcend the humanness? How do we bring those together? Does that make sense? Does that help? Yeah. And that's what the Buddha is. That's exactly right. The Buddha, I think we're blessed in Buddhism, that the Buddha awoken, and then he had like another 40 years to integrate that and to deepen and to teach. And I think that's one of the, again, I'm being really putting myself out on a limb, but maybe that's one of the problems with Christianity, is that Jesus didn't have a chance to teach long enough. You know, he had this deep understanding, and then, you know, he got crucified. And if he had another 40 years, I think we would have a very different experience of Christianity than we do now. So hopefully I won't get a bunch of hate mail, but oh well, I'll deal with it. Okay, thank you, Iris. All right. Yes, Beth, come on up.
So first of all, postmodern Christology would agree with you, what you just said. So
good.
I was sharing in the group. I was on Friday. I was I don't know what was going on. I guess rainbows and unicorns of some form or fashion. That was, I didn't call it emptiness, but I would definitely call it the zone. I was sort of rocking in life, and yet two arisings came to me in the span of, you know, two events, two pieces of information that were a blow, that I felt as a blow. And I felt it as an emotional, you know, arrow, two arrows actually. And it was a surprise. Surprise, the details of the blows were a surprise, and my reaction was a surprise, the injury, feeling the pain, the upset. The narrative, you know, storyline 357 was definitely identified, but not like taken down the road too many times, but the pain was very, very clear. It was, I went into the emotional level of capacity, you know, emotional capacity, the emotional level of consciousness to try to ground it, and did what I could do to process it without trying to like push it away. And that's the trick for me.
Yeah.
Is how to hold it in mindfulness or willingness, and have it still be willing to be a part of my life and a part of my current situation. Not to say I've dealt with that. Let's get on with it. And what came to mind, and this, I find this reassuring. So this is an experience I told the group. It's okay to say this, you think. A few months ago, I was in my garage and I found a rat who was actively dying, mm-hmm. clearly had been poisoned, not by me, but had been poisoned and was, and this rat in actively moving slower and slower was still doing what rats do. He was like, you know, pointing in one direction and trying to find food here and moving around. And I thought to myself, that's what my mind is going to be doing until my last breath. Mm. I'm like the rat. I mean, this is what mind does. It's not going to stop. Mm. And I find that to be reassuring to remind myself that it's like, well, you know, that's what the mind does. It's just going to keep nosing around and doing what it does. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Beth. So that the last thing you just said is, you know, inherent in the way you said it is that you also realized you're not your mind.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
I think that's an important piece there because we often think we are our minds, or our mind states, or our mind's preferences. And yeah, there is that quality of, you know, the rat looking for food, even though when it's slowing down and it's getting near the end of its life, there will be that potential is still there. But if we see that we're not in our minds, then we have that choice of, okay, how much do I really follow that? You know, how much do I allow that comes up? I may, you know, snap at somebody, or I might be this or that, but there's that returning to. And with that experience that you had, but I have time here, of, you know, feeling that you talked about unicorns and stuff, that kind of the depth, you know, it's like it was a kind of a sparkly,
sparkly zone
of happiness. And then life kind of interjected pain and suffering. And you talked about that willingness to turn toward, and that's that, you know, so, you know, like, of course it's painful. We want to go away from that. But here we turn toward it. That's the sincerity of the practitioner. It's also the discernment about turning toward, can I turn toward this, you know, right now? Or do I need to maybe find other supports to help me turn toward it? Or do I need to take a break? You know, there's that discernment about what's my capacity to turn towards something? And that's my favorite way when people talk about way of answering when people talk about physical pain. It's like, okay, what do I do with that physical pain? You know, and I just ask, well, what's your capacity to hold it? You know, each one of us, perhaps even right now, there's physical pain that's beyond our capacity to hold. And if we try to force ourselves to hold it, it becomes, it's really using the practice against us. It's good to bring that sense of wisdom. It's the same thing with emotional pain, with grief, with mental pain, is to realize it's not just about just diving into the depth of it. It's learning, okay, how can I turn toward it, like what Arsh is talking about, with that quality of mindfulness? Or does that mindfulness start to get too tense and too restricted? And then it's helpful to step back and find a different way of relating to it. Yeah. So thank you.
One more thing?
Yes.
Another thing we mentioned was that balance, what you were talking about, finding a different way to relate to it, or just maybe taking a break. And we talked about, I mentioned hearing Norman Fisher say during one of the weekends he was here how this is hard work. You know, it is work, it's effort. And he said, sometimes just take a break. There's a lot of good stuff on Netflix. And I remember him saying that. I'm like, wow, he's saying that? Cool. You know, I mean, and that sort of for me relates to what you're saying. Some kinds, you know, like know when you have choice to move toward and then to back away.
Yeah.
To that provides equilibrium in the long run.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes the backward step, you know, the distraction is actually a faster way through because you're giving yourself a respite. Yeah. Thank you, Beth. All right. Back online. Trying to hold you two groups equally. Okay, Maddie, go ahead.
Hey, Tim. Something that came up in our group is how these experiences of emptiness can feel a lot like oneness, fullness, you know, not really empty at all. And I've heard that, you know, the things I've read about how, like, yeah, sometimes like the word empty doesn't, you know, fully communicate what this feeling is like. But I was wondering, I wondered this myself, why, so my intuition is that, like, there's kind of different angles of the same thing. I was wondering from your perspective, why kind of the Buddhist angle on it is usually emptiness. And if you think that is also maybe like fullness, or, you know, is there a more complete picture of this thing?
Yes. Yeah. That's a good question. Common question. Cause yeah, emptiness, the experience of it, it feels like anything except empty, because there is that richness, fullness, vividness of things. But really what it's an empty of is probably the question. And that's it's the empty of that, really that's that constricted, contracted sense of me that's creating separation. That's what's, I think, and emptiness is really a Zen term. And that's, you know, part of it is the culture, the Japanese and Chinese culture, Korean culture, Vietnamese, all the ways that Zen kind of developed. Part of it is that's one way of seeing it, of talking about it. But it really is pointing toward that empty of self, of separation. And, but it's not, yeah, empty. It's not the right experience. It's not the right description of that. It's like there's this, you know, like even saying silence and stillness is like there's this roar of something here. Yeah. So exactly right. Yeah. There's, it's not always the best word, and you can always find your own translation of it. That's why sometimes I like talking about, like using the Sufi way of describing it, or some of the Christian mystics. It just has this other way of describing it. I think there's one more word about it is, in, Rahula's book, What the Buddha Taught, he makes this point that Nibbana and enlightenment is often described as what it's not. You know, it's kind of intentional, because if we say what it is, that gives the mind something to glimpse, you know, cling to direct towards, to stick to. While we describe what it's not, then it's like, okay, it's a process of elimination, process of uncovering what's here. So that's part of the dialogue. Emptiness is, yeah, sometimes that's not the right word, but it's anything but empty, but it is empty of self. All right. Thanks, Maddie. All right. Back online, or in person, I should say. Sometimes I get confused about who's online and who's in person, because it does actually feel connected to those online as much as those here in the room. All right. We got this other Beth. It's an all Beth night.
Now, maybe you can tell me if this relates at all, because I'm still trying to kind of grasp the idea of emptiness. And what you were just saying was very helpful, actually. So during the sit, let me preface. In the past 6 months, my father and my father-in-law both died suddenly. And during the sit, feeling my breath, I began thinking about their final breaths and the sort of what would seem to me like the maybe a panic. But then was able to sort of step away from the story of that.
Yeah.
And to just feel the ache of loss.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that is sort of somehow relates to what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, just hang out there in case I have a follow-up response that you might have. So the sense of panic, was it around imagining their own last breaths or your own last breath? Theirs, yeah. It was the panic around that, the immensity of their grief or what they might be going through, realizing this is their last breath.
Yeah, that moment of like,
this is, yeah, this is, were you there when they passed?
I wasn't, but yeah. I got some really thorough stories.
Yes. Yeah, so that last breath and the sometimes there's the panic, sometimes it's a very just peaceful release. You know, there's many ways it shows up. But what I think the way it ties in, at least the way I would say it, you know, right now in this interpretation, is that one of the things that the emptiness is empty of is the future and the past. It's like those just fall away. And that last breath of our life is like, okay, there is no more futures. There's no more future breaths. There's no more past breaths. It's like there's this complete letting go into, you know, into non-existence, if you will. That ties very much into sometimes the Zen, there are these great phrases that we try to die before we die. You know, and what they mean by that, at least what I think they mean, what resonates for me, is that deep releasing into this present moment, that really releasing the future, releasing the past. And in that releasing, there is a sort of death of our ego, of our identification of who we take ourselves to be. And so when someone dies, often, depending on how they lived and how their relationship to that self is like, that's everything. Everything is going away. And some people, because of how they lived or their experiences, they see it as the stepping into something that's beyond knowing. And so that was really helpful when Rodney used to teach a lot about death and dying and still does. But there's that, you know, there's that real painful part of that. When you contemplate others' death, and especially so fresh with your father and your father-in-law dying, it's just so easily to be overwhelmed by it. And what helped me is to start to notice, okay, there is a way that there's a little death in each moment. There's a releasing to that. And what are we releasing into is that stillness, that emptiness, the release of the future and the past. And yes, yeah, at the end of our last physical breath, there's that intensity of that. But we can practice that in a way just right in every sitting. Thank you, Beth. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's a very tender experience. And that's a great example of story and emptiness and how they come together. And how do we meet that? How are we open to that in a way that doesn't exclude either one of them? All right, so we've come to that. Speaking of releasing time, we've come to 9 o'clock. And some teachers will just keep on going, but I'm not ready to do that yet to you. So thank you for your engagement. I know this is a little challenging, a little out there, but hopefully it, you know, has some use. And this year's series, I know it's been maybe more concrete at the beginning and then more obscure or esoteric in the end. And next month, again, we'll go into how do we really come back into the village. And then the final month, December, we'll kind of look at the whole of it now that we've gone through it. So Tuari Salah will be here next week. She's planning on being here next week and the week after. And then I'll be back on Halloween. So costumes are optional. All right. Thank you all.